My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I'm replacing the speaker tonight who didn't make it here. And I have to admit that I'm the one that messes with the preamble every single week. And poor Jess has to read it, but what are you going to do? My very first drink was sometime 1968 or 69. What happened was, when I first started drinking, I experienced the phenomenon of craving. It's something I didn't recognize or understand until I was a couple of years into sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what it was. But with alcoholics, what happens is, when you take the first drink asks for the second drink. The second drink insists on the third drink. The third drink demands the fourth drink. And that's usually why we get completely trashed drunk. And a lot of the people we're drinking with don't. They do things like, they say, "No thanks, I've had enough." You know, you ever drink with people like that? People that have had enough? I don't know about you, but it's very disconcerting for me when that happens. The engines are running with me, and I need to keep going until I'm unconscious. And it's just inconvenient to be drinking with somebody who wants to go home, because they've had their three beers or something. Another thing that happened was after I took that first drink and I got drunk, I experienced something during that experience that made me preoccupied with liquor from that point forward. Some of the characteristics that I had prior to drinking, because I don't believe I became alcoholic because I drank. I believe I drank because I was alcoholic. There's a big difference in that perception. What happened as a pre-alcoholic who hadn't been introduced to alcohol yet was I had a lot of character traits. I had a lot of emotional baggage. I had a lot of spiritual unmanageability, and it manifested itself in a number of different ways. But generally what it was like was I became very, very uncomfortable in certain situations, in most situations. You know, I was really only good when I was by myself. And there was problems with that. There was things like school and stuff where they made you like congregate with other people. And that unnerved me a little bit, you know. I remember the first time I was taken off to school, it was kindergarten, you know, 1960. And my mother comes up and says, today's the day. We're going to get you dressed up. It's kindergarten today. And I'm like, all right. I didn't know much about it. I got in the car. She dropped me off at kindergarten, said, "There's the building, you know, go down and have at it." And I remember she drove away, and I remember standing up on the hill looking down at this school building. And the kids are already friends. It looked like to me they're playing kickball and tag. They've already assimilated into their peer group. And I'm standing up on the hill looking down there, just looking, I'm feeling like a dick. You know what I mean? I'm like, I can't go down there. You know, this is, something's wrong with this. Whose idea was this? You know, what if they don't like me? What if I do something stupid? I was already completely preoccupied with how other people, like, viewed me. And I was already, like, had that social anxiety or whatever. And, you know, it got worse from there. I had all kinds of difficulties, with my emotional condition. And the first time I drank, what happened was, it was the actual first experience I ever had of freedom from that bondage to my emotional and psychic spiritual condition. I'll give you another example of where I was just whacked prior to drinking. Does anybody remember square dancing from school? Holy God! I can't believe that they did that to people. You know? There's therapists that are still making money from this today. Okay, but what they would do is they would line all the boys up on one side of the gym and all the girls up on the other side of the gym. They'd blow the whistle and you'd have to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance with you. Okay? Nothing like trauma for like a pre-alcoholic. I was telling this story one time and after the meeting, this woman comes up to me and goes, how do you think we felt? You know? Like it's just the charge of the light brigade coming across the room. Oh my God, oh my God. So, I mean, this was the kind of stuff where it didn't affect these normal idiots. They were like, oh, it's barn dance day. You know? I'm like wanting to kill myself. Now what happened when I first drank the alcohol was I got a freedom. I got a new freedom and a new happiness from this alcohol. All of a sudden, this self-centered fear and anxiety just dropped from me. And all of a sudden, I was good. You know what I mean? I was cool. I wasn't afraid of anything. You know what I mean? I mean, there were dancing lessons in that bottle. I mean, all of a sudden, I'd have no problem running across the gym. It was what I was looking for. I don't even know if I was looking for it because I hadn't experienced it before, but all of a sudden it was the magic anti-crisp potion. And all of a sudden I saw, this is why people drink. They drink so that they can be normal. Because that's what I was going after alcohol for. Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd don't drink to be normal. They have like two glasses of wine, they get a little lightheaded, and that's about it for them, okay? They have a non-alcoholic reaction. My alcoholic reaction was one of, I needed this stuff now to be able to deal. And I started to become preoccupied with alcohol, even though it made me unbelievably ill. I started to become preoccupied with alcohol, and I started to figure out where I was going to drink it, who I was going to drink it with, what it was going to be. The first drink I had was Four Roses whiskey, which made me incredibly violently ill. So from that point on, I steered clear of Four Roses, but I understood the power of alcohol. So I started drinking the 12-year-old drinks like Boone's Farm apple wine, and stuff like, remember that crap? Strawberry Hill. And if you were really cool, you'd drink like Night Train or MD 2020. I mean, this is what we were drinking, Blackberry Brandy, This is god-awful stuff. But it was something that you could swallow if you were 12. So I started to become preoccupied with all that. And, I was moving through my life, and things were getting more and more unmanageable. I wasn't paying attention to the things that you were expected to pay attention to in my grades, like school and things like that. They were starting to get in the way of the things that I wanted to do. One of the things I did in high school was I took Wednesdays off all the way through high school. I really thought 5 days in a row of school was onerous. You know what I mean? I just didn't think that was right, so I broke up the week. And, the teacher would go, where's Chris today? And everybody would go, it's Wednesday, it's his day off. Okay. So that gives you an idea of how high academic excellence was on my barometer. But, I started the party. I certainly started to get involved in the extracurricular substance activities that were going on. In those days, this is the very late 60s, or very early 70s, and there was a lot of, there was a lot of drugs around, okay? And I was inclusive. I was non-discriminatory with some of these things. And I will qualify it with this. Alcohol was always there first and it was always there after. If I was using drugs, it was to elongate my drunk, or to manage my hangover, usually. But every once in a while, I would allow myself to be over-medicated, and their problems would ensue. Probably one of my favorite episodes was, Steve's in the back, he went to school with me. He'll remember this, the Quaalude epidemic of 72. He's got some identification with this. A really good friend of ours, had a brother who, like, you know, dealt. And what happened was the night before, he gave our friend John a sack of Quaalude Roar 714s and said, sell these at school tomorrow. And now, if anybody is unfamiliar with the old Roar 714s, if you took one, it's like drinking a six-pack of Tall Boys in 4 seconds. That's kind of what the effect is like. So he gets to school, and you know, we're all congregating in the smoking section, and he goes, I've got Quaaludes. And we're all like, okay, how much do they cost, and how many do you take? He goes, they're $2 a piece, and take 3 or 4. So about 50 of us took 3 or 4 Quaaludes before first period in high school. The ambulance was back and forth all day long. The last thing I remember is walking down the hallway, hanging onto the lockers like this, you know, and I realized, you know, this is getting bad. I got to make a break for it, right? So I see the exit sign and I make a break, and I go through the doors and I head for the woods. Now, the next day, everybody's coming up to me and saying, Chris, man, that was hysterical yesterday, you know, seeing you head for the woods. It took you 15 minutes to go 100 yards, you know? And I thought I was moving. That was really bad. A lot of concerts. We went to a lot of rock concerts. Saw a lot of the great classic rock bands back in those days. And another place where we would allow ourselves to become over-medicated was at the concerts. I remember this one time we went to see Wishbone Ash and Foghat or something at the Capitol. And I remember we went in the bathroom and we were buying drugs, and some of these guys were selling LSD. So we bought some LSD and we took it. And about 15 minutes later, there's nothing, right? So we go back, you know, we got ripped off. And we go back and we buy more from different people and we take that, you know, about 15 minutes later, still nothing. So we go back in, we got ripped off again. And finally, you know, we buy some, well, about like the last set of the concert, all of a sudden, whoa! It's like Disney World in 3D, you know? And you know, we're walking out, we all pile in the van and we're heading back to Jersey. Now, you know where the Lincoln Tunnel goes from like a whole bunch of lanes down into two? We're driving in the van and, you know, we're heading down toward the tunnel. And somebody goes, hey man, we'll never fit. Right? So, you know, we all start moving to the front of the van to check this out. And we're like, he's right! We're never going to fit! It's a mouse hole! You know? So we start to back out. It took us 45 minutes to back out. People were honking. We had to take the bridge. You know, this kind of activity was always happening to us. And, you know, it was just, I met up with somebody at the Sunday night meeting a couple of months ago. She was just celebrating there as a fluke, okay? And she gets up and she introduces herself as Lisa. You know, I don't recognize her. Lisa, okay. She grew up in Basking Ridge. Okay, my radar's going up a little. She, you know, she gives her age through, you know, saying when she got sober and what age she got sober at. So I did a little math and I realized, oh my God, I drank with her. I like partied with this girl like crazy, and I hadn't seen her in like 35 years. So I go up to her after the meeting and I introduce myself to her. You know, yo, it's you. You know, we're hugging and stuff. And she goes, you know, the one thing I remember about you, I go, yeah. She goes, it's you slurred a lot. She says, you slurred all the time. Do you know what that means? That means I was drunk all the time. You know, so this, it got bad. I moved down to Florida. I don't know, a friend of mine had come back up from Florida and said, oh man, you gotta see this place. There's a bar in every building on campus, you know, there's parties every night. I'm like signing up, for this college. I don't even know what they're doing, you know. I don't even know what the majors are down there. But I'm down in Florida and my partying is really taking off. I met a wonderful codependent. When I was in high school, she came from a really, really alcoholic family. Mother and father dropped dead tongue-chewing, knee-walking alcoholics, you know? And brothers, all three brothers have died of alcoholism. I mean, just a brutal household. So when she met me, I felt like home to her, you know? So it was a beautiful relationship. She thought about me as much as I did. And, you know, that was one of the criteria I had for relationships. And so we started our dance of death, and we moved down to Florida. You know, it got so bad even she couldn't take it down there. I mean, I was crashing cars. I crashed so many cars. You know, does anybody here come from a time when friends let friends drive drunk? You know what I mean? I mean, that was us. Nobody taking away my keys, you know, that's them's fighting words, you know, the early 70s. So I ended up crashing a lot of cars, and I crashed some down in Florida. And, you know, it got to the point where it was really, my wife had a daughter, and she was really thinking about trying to start a healthy family unit or something, that I found inconvenient. I couldn't provide the emotional or financial security that this family needed. I mean, I wasn't wired for that, you know? You want me to get a job? You want me to come home at night? You know, insurance on the car? You know, all these things that I just saw as real unreasonable. And, you know, what happened was it just got to the point where she had to leave. And that's when my drinking really took a nosedive, because now I drank because she left me when I needed her most. You know what I mean? And so for the next couple of years, I was just out of my mind drunk. And, you know, it got worse and worse and worse. Finally in Florida, what happened was the cops were after me, outstanding warrants, you know, didn't do community service, owed all this money, you know, creditors, you know, people knocking on the door, phone ringing. It got to the point where it was, you know, time to move, you know. So what do you do? I'll tell you what I did. I figured that mom needed some help around the house, back in New Jersey. So off I go back to New Jersey. I was only going to stay there for 8 years at mom's, you know, and completely destroy her life, burn the house down twice, and that was really ugly. you know, what happened was, alcoholism is progressive. It's a progressive malady. One of the real sad things about alcoholism is a lot of times it doesn't allow you the dignity of a true perspective on how much trouble you're in. The milkman knows you're in trouble before you do. It's a disease of minimization. If you're new, if you haven't gone through the steps, I know one thing that's very, very true about you. You are minimizing like a sumbitch. Okay? You're in 10 times more trouble than you think you are, and you don't even know it. That's inherent in alcoholism. You know, so finally I get to a point where life is just becoming incredibly, incredibly painful for me to live. This is a typical day for me. I'll come to with the alarm going off around 7:30 in the morning. I'll be wearing the clothes I was in the night before. Sometimes I'll be sleeping on the floor because I passed out while I was sitting up drinking every single night. You know, clunk, I just land on the floor. So I would come to, I would be reeking of alcohol. It may have been 10, 12 hours since I had my last drink, but it was coming out of my pores. I was a vodka or a bourbon drinker, and I drank a lot of it. So I would stagger to my feet, you know, I'd go into the bathroom, you know, I'd do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, because I smoked a lot. You know, brush my teeth, get in the car, you know, off to work, and I'd get to work. I was an electrician at this period of time, which is really kind of a bad trade to be in when you know, detox from alcohol every day, because I was constantly blowing stuff up and, you know, setting fires, and, you know, my boss would be mad. But I, you know, I'd head off to work, and if I'd gotten pulled over at 7:45 in the morning, I would have got a DWI, and I hadn't had a drink since like 8 o'clock the night before. It was just so coming out of my pores. And I'd get to work, and my boss would say something like, "Oh, I want you to go to this, go to this, go to this." I'd get in the truck, and I'd drive out of the driveway. I'd be at the end of the driveway. I'd think, "What the hell did he want me to do?" You know, I couldn't remember what he wanted me to do, so I'd have to go back, you know, and be all embarrassed. "What did you tell me to do?" And I would be horrifically ill. A normal earth person would be in the emergency room, feeling the way we do with our hangovers. You know, we just get used to them, and we learn how to suffer through them. And that's what I would do. But I would be swearing to God that today is the day I'm never going to drink again. Today is the day. I'm throwing away the booze. I'm starting a new life. Today. Now, if there was a polygraph guy handy and he hooked me up to a lie detector, I would be telling the truth. At 8 or 9 in the morning, I was never going to drink again, and that was final. But what would happen is, about halfway through the day, I'd get half a sandwich down, rehydrate up, and I'd think to myself, you know that position on never drinking again that I made this morning? That's a pretty stiff position, you know? That's pretty inflexible. I might have to modify that a little bit. As a matter of fact, I might have to go to the liquor store on the way home today. And that's exactly what I would do. I would go to the liquor store on the way home. Now, here's how the obsession of the mind, here's how the insanity of alcoholism shows up with us. The decision to never drink again is a sane, sound, reasonable, logical decision. For somebody that's alcoholic, putting alcohol in your body is insane. It's the stupidest thing you can do. You know, no wonder we get locked up and put in institutions. It's because we're idiots. You know, we're nuts. Putting alcohol in our body if we're alcoholic is insane. So what happens is I go from a very sound, sane decision in the morning. Slowly, the insanity of alcoholism or the obsession of the mind comes on me during the day. And by the afternoon when I'm leaving work, I'm on my way to buy another bottle of vodka to do this whole god-awful thing again. And what happens is, we fool ourselves with this. We don't give the obsession of the mind, the powerlessness of alcoholism, enough weight, and we minimize it. Our ego wants us to take responsibility for drinking. "Well, I drank today because I had a tough day at work." No, you drank because you're insane. That's why you drank, because any alcoholic that puts alcohol in their body is completely insane. You know, has a completely unmanageable life and should probably be locked up so that they don't hurt themselves and others. You know, that, I mean, it's booby hatch type insanity. And we don't give it that credit. You know, we don't give it that sense of urgency. But what happened to me was, I finally got to a point where it was catching my attention enough that I decided to go to a treatment program. I'd been to this treatment center, down Route 202 before to get my license back for a third DWI. And I had to sit through the god-awful outpatient group. Anybody ever done outpatient group? Where you sit in a circle and you listen to one muttonhead after the other tell you how screwed up their day is? Where in hell did that come from? Okay? Trying to treat alcoholism with group is you're going to a gunfight with a penknife. Let me tell you. Anyway, I'd been to a group, and what I had learned was that if you're in real trouble, upstairs is the big rehab, and you go there for 28 days, and they can throw a cure, throw a fixin' on you, you know, if probably. So it got to the point where it was Christmas 1989. My whole family was home for Christmas. I'm drinking Johnny Walker Black, my traditional Christmas drink. Did anyone ever have a traditional Christmas drink? You know, I did. And I got really drunk and I got a resentment. I don't even remember what this resentment is like. You know those resentments? You're just like, you bastards! You know, type of a resentment. And I threatened my entire family. I was going to kill them all. You know, this is my mother, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, you know, family, animals. I'm going to kill all of you! And they took off, because they knew me well enough to know I'd be eminently remorseful, but I'd probably kill them, so they left. And I came to, and it was, they talk about this in the book, the hideous four horsemen, terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. And then they describe pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's where I was at. I could not imagine going on with this kind of pain in my life. The pain that my alcoholism was causing. Not necessarily my drinking. The pain of my alcoholism, which was all the emotional and psychic trauma that I was going through. I couldn't imagine moving forward with that. And I couldn't imagine living without alcohol. I was at that jumping off place. I'd been to rehab by this time, and you know, I'd done the outpatient. I'd been going to some AA meetings, and it's funny, the AA meetings I was going to resembled very much group. You know, you guys know the closed-minded discussion meetings where you know everybody sits around in a big circle and everybody shares about their day. Well, my day. Let me tell you about my day. My day really sucked. You wouldn't believe my day. And then somebody will, oh, your day sucked. Let me tell you how much my day sucked. So I didn't know any better. I'm going to these really bad group therapy without a facilitator $1 meetings. But I'm sober. I'm desperate. I'm going to like 14 meetings a week. I'd gotten a sponsor, Fish Food Phil, by this time. I'd even taken on some commitments, tried to start making some friends. I was working what I thought was a program, because that's what they were telling me. You go to a lot of meetings, get a sponsor, you know, that's working a program. You're working a good program, Chris. But the problem is I'm a page 20 real alcoholic. 80% of the people that show up in Alcoholics Anonymous today are not what the big book would describe as real alcoholics. They're somewhere on the scale of alcoholism, quite possibly, but they're not at the depths of what is described in the book as a real alcoholic. They're not completely powerless over alcohol. And a lot of times they misunderstand the real alcoholics. They're the people that say, you relapsed again, kid? You must not really want it. You know, you must not be honest with yourself. You know, these are typical reactions from people that can quit drinking because they want to, who misunderstand the people that can't quit at all because they're powerless over alcohol. Here's the thing, if you're admitting to powerlessness over alcohol, you're admitting that you have no power to keep alcohol from going into your body. And you have no power how many drinks you're going to take once you start drinking. That's what powerlessness is. And yet I was hearing in the meetings all the time back in the 80s and early 90s, you know, just don't take a drink, even if your ass falls off. I got to tell you, I'm drinking 2 weeks before my ass falls off. I am not walking around with a falling off ass sober. And, you know, if you feel like taking a drink, call your sponsor. The problem is if you feel like taking a drink, you don't have time for the sponsor. All that stuff is history. None of that stuff is a defense against a drink. Swallowing the little 90-day pen, that's not a defense against the first drink. That's a chaser. You know what I'm saying? The real alcoholic, I mean, just read the first couple of chapters of the book. The real alcoholic, there are times when the most unbelievably strong desire to stay away from alcohol means nothing. The consequences of drinking means nothing. There was a home group member in here who we were working with years ago. He was one of the cannot or will not. You know, I love the way Bill said it. There are people who cannot or will not. He didn't say they were idiots or, you know, they were losers. He said they cannot or they will not, you know, grab this simple program. And this guy was one of them. Now, what happens with advanced stages of alcoholism sometimes is your liver starts to just quit. And some stuff backs up. The liver can't really operate right. And what happens is you don't clot correctly, and you get this thing called, it's called esophageal varices. For anybody that doesn't know what that is, that's when your throat explodes and you choke to death on your own blood. It's not pretty, but it happens to a lot of us. And the treatment for it is prying your mouth open in the emergency room and cauterizing your throat with like a cattle prod, okay? This is going to get your attention, isn't it? You know, you've got tubes coming out of every orifice in your body. The machines are beeping. You know, you got 7 triage nurses. This should get your attention, right? Well, we're talking with this guy afterward, and we go, you realize that you're an alcoholic at the end stages, the acute stages of alcoholism, right? Yeah. You know that you have to go like crazy to AA meetings. You got to work the steps with a sponsor. You got to start sponsoring people. You got to take commitments. You have got to be all over this recovery thing, right? Yeah. Okay, I want to see you at Tuesday night meeting. You know, we're going to get together. We'll drive you there. We'll get you started on the program. Oh, wow, man. Like, Tuesday's no good. You're dying. You know, you're dying. And what, Friends is on or something? What's the matter with you? And he goes, after all this, I really need a vacation. You know, so he went on a vacation, he drank, and he got another esophageal varices. Really, you rarely survive two of them. It's not a good, you don't have good chance of surviving one of them. But he survived another one, and we started working with this guy again. And we gave him the same song and dance. Look, man, we'll help you. You need to be aggressive with this recovery stuff. Forget the job, forget the wife, sell the kids. You know, get rid of the pets, you know. Just put everything on hold for a long time and let's do AA.
I don't know, man.
What is that? What is that? I'll tell you what. Alcoholism doesn't allow you the same dignity of understanding the urgency that some other illness would, okay? I'll give you, for instance, you're dying of pancreas cancer, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor said, look, this is progressively fatal, you know, you're going to check out maybe soon, maybe in a while, it's going to not be a really great death, you know, here's your bill, and you'll say, you know, wait a minute, doc, wait a minute, isn't there anything? And the doctor says, well, there's this new trial program in Seattle. It's like a 12-procedure, you know, process, and you know, rarely have we seen a person not recover who's actually done that. What would you do? You would move heaven and earth to get to Seattle to engage in that recovery process because you know you're going to die if you don't. Yet alcoholism doesn't allow us that same clarity of mind, that same sense of urgency. We minimize like sons of bitches. Now, my experience was what pushed me toward the steps was a weird series of circumstances. This buddy of mine, Radio Shack Mike, was a tape listener. Okay, he loved these tapes, and he would go to the New Age bookstore and just buy everything. You know, the Wisdom of Crystals. Succeeding through standing on your head. I mean, it didn't matter what, this guy would read it and listen to it. And this one time he gave me a set of tapes. The first set of tapes he gave me were affirmation tapes. And he said, you know, I do these every day, you should try them, okay? So I take these affirmation tapes home. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to listen to them on a tape recorder, and it says, okay, stand in front of the mirror and say 100 times, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. So I'm standing in front of the room, Chris, you're one of a guy. Chris, you're one of a guy. Chris, I'm a scumbag! You know, throw the tapes out the window. You know, what are you giving me that crap for? You know, and I realize in hindsight, you know, trying to treat the emotional trauma of alcoholism with an affirmation is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. But I didn't know any different back then. Now he gives me another set of tapes, so I'm a little bit leery. It's 90 minute tapes. My God. What an overreaction that is going to be. But I had a long ride to work, so I started listening to it. What it was one of the earlier Joe and Charlie big book studies. And I started to hear some things in that big book study that I wasn't hearing in North Jersey AA. It was not around. This went at odds with all of my preconceptions about what AA was. I was convinced working a program was going to a lot of meetings, because that's what I was being told. What Joe and Charlie said was, no, Chris, you're engaging in fellowship. That's one side of our triangle. One of the other sides of the triangle is recovery, and what recovery is actually taking the spiritual exercises out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually doing the steps as they're laid out in the big book. And Chris, if you're not doing that, do not tell people you're working an AA program, because that's what an AA program is, working the steps out of the big book. And if you don't do that, when you go back out, please don't tell anybody that AA doesn't work. We don't need another black eye from an idiot like you. Okay? The third piece of the triangle is service, which is about carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholic. That's sponsoring. That's carrying the 12 steps to the other alcoholic. That's making the carrying of the 12 steps possible. This is basically the message I got from the Joe and Charlie tapes, as well as a really good explanation on the mechanics of the steps, how actually to take them. Now, my first impression was, screw these Arkansas idiots. You know what I mean? What do these guys in Arkansas know? This ain't the way we do it in New Jersey, because it wasn't. But what happened was that untreated alcoholism that I had, the restlessness, the irritability, the discontent, the being prey to misery, depression, anxiety, guilt, remorse, shame, just an inability to be able to deal or to be comfortable with myself or my environment, that alcoholism that I had when I was 5 was still all over me. And it was getting worse because I wasn't drinking. So I had a couple of things that happened that sent me into a really bad state. I mean, it was either drink or kill myself or find something. I mean, a lot of times that's what happens to us. We hit sober bottoms. And we get to a point where we either have to drink, we have to put a bullet through our head, or we have to search for something to help us, because we cannot move forward with this kind of emotional and spiritual trauma. We can't. So what happened was, I went back to these tapes, and the truth will haunt you sometimes. I wasn't happy with what Joe and Charlie said, because it went at odds, and it meant work for me. And no alcoholic wants to hear the term work, the work. If somebody, you know, when I came into AA in 1962, if somebody would have said I had to do the work, I would have been right out the goddamn door. You ever hear like an old timer say something like that? That's a non-alcoholic old-timer, guys. I hate to tell you. Anyway, not that I judge. We do have infiltrators in here, because they say AA is the happening place today, you know? There was a guy that was going for one of the political positions around here, who was in the meetings, and he figured he'd blow his anonymity before they'd blow it for him. And in a newspaper article, he said, "Yeah, I go to AA. It's a great place to go to find out where the fishing holes are and restaurants are." Oh my God, that's just what we need. People that are looking for fishing holes. Thank you for that. I have enough trouble in some of the meetings I go to without fishing hole people. Anyway, what happened was, I pulled out these tapes and I started to give them renewed attention. I started to actually play them, actually open up the book Alcoholics Anonymous, actually start to go through these steps. And when the book said, you know, The people we resented, we put them down in black and white. I actually, you know, put them down in black and white. And I did this crazy bastardized thing. It was the best I could do with the Charlie tapes in the book. And I started to work a program. And here's what I found. I found that the alcoholic condition, which is the emotional and the spiritual condition, that's at best being restless, irritable, and discontented. At worst, having pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization in a sober state without alcohol. I realized that what the steps were doing was they were treating that condition. They were treating that separateness that I felt, the uncomfortability that I felt between, you know, in myself and my environment, my social actions and in my personal relationships and in my ability to just get through the day. What the steps did was they treated that dysfunction. They treated that condition. And I didn't know that going in. You don't know so much in AA until you actually experience it. There's two ways to learn, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous. One is intellectually. If you read the book a bunch of times, if you go to step meetings until the cows come home like I did in the early days, you can learn to give good share, you know, you can learn the recovery terminology. You can learn a lot of stuff, but it doesn't help you to recover to learn intellectually. To learn experientially, that's when you actually do one of these steps. You take the action. That's how you learn to recover. What Alcoholics Anonymous is filled with today is it's filled with people that will give you their opinion on experiences they've never had. I'll give you, for instance, have you ever heard this? You're in a step meeting and somebody raises their hand and says, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to take the meeting hostage for the next 10 minutes, giving you my opinion on all the crap I think in my head. Has that ever happened to you? Happens all the time, doesn't it? You know, that's somebody who has a bunch of intellectual knowledge but no experience. The thing we need more of in Alcoholics Anonymous today is people with experience. You know, I believe the steps have to be taken. That's my experience. I started working with some people after I'd gone through the steps. This was sometime in the early 90s. Some of them are even here. There's a couple of my early guinea pigs that are in here somewhere. And what I was doing was, there was a lot of guys that I was sponsoring because I had learned to give good share. I knew how to, you know, just be self-deprecating enough and make a couple of jokes about how stupid I was to kind of be endearing to everybody. You know, that crap, you know, you think like, what am I going to share and how am I going to share and I got to make it funny. You know, I learned how to do that and I learned how to give pretty good share. And in the middle of my going through the steps, I get to the end of the steps, and I've got a bunch of these sponsees because the crazy ones were attracted to me for some reason. And a lot of them were drinking on me. You ever have sponsees drink on you? Doesn't that make you look bad? Is Harry yours? You know, he's drinking, and he's hitting on the new women, and, you know, borrowing money. Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him. So what happened was, just for the hell of it, I decided to start bringing some of these people over to my house, and I started taking them through the steps. We started at page one in the big book and went through, and whenever there was an instruction, I'd make sure they were clear on the instruction, to the best of my knowledge. And I learned something very significant, that this is from the mid to early 90s. The people that actually went through and did the fourth and the fifth step, the eighth and the ninth step, learned the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, and started working with other people. Every single one of them is still in AA today. Every single one of them. They're card-carrying members in good standing. They all still work with other alcoholics. And the important thing is their quality of life is through the roof. It doesn't matter about their economic situations or whatever. The quality of their life is out the roof. They're really enjoying every single second on this planet. They've learned how to live the way we're meant to live, which is to be very grateful and to have a lot of fun with this gift of life. The people who didn't,
who said, Chris, would you sponsor me? Well, yeah, you know, come on over, we'll start doing a four-step. Well, you know, the four-step thing might have to wait. You know, I usually tour with the Dead in the summer.
You know, all of those people actually have drifted away. I don't know whether they're drinking or not, because we get a lot of non-alcoholics in AA. We get a lot. Here's how it's described clinically. You have alcohol abuse and you have alcohol dependence. The alcohol dependent people are the people who are alcoholic. They're dependent on alcohol to deal, to brush their teeth, to get the mail. They're alcoholic dependent. You've got a lot of alcohol abusers who come into AA. They've had a couple of DUIs, you know, they burned a couple of houses down, you know, they robbed a couple of 7-Elevens or, you know, got busted with drugs. We get a lot of drug abusers in here. And that's fine. The doors of AA are wide enough that you know, you have a drinking problem, you are welcome here, we want to save you that 10 or 20 years of drinking that you could have if you didn't decide to do something about it. The message that needs to be carried in AA today is, if you are a real alcoholic and you understand some of the things that I'm sharing, and you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, it's incumbent upon us to find the alcoholics before they die in AA, because they're not being exposed to a recovery process. There's a great line that Bill Wilson writes. I can't quote it, but he's basically saying, you know, we really don't want to be the reason why people die. It's incumbent upon us to provide an adequate presentation of the 12 steps to the alcoholic. What happened with AA, I believe, is in the early days, this is what AA looked like in the first 10 or 15 years. You met on Monday night, all the alcoholics in somebody's house, and you talked about, okay, what are we going to do this week? Who are we going to go find? How are we going to help people? And, you know, you talked together. And then on Tuesday, you went to the hospital to look for drunks. On Wednesday, you went to the mental hospital to look for drunks. On Thursday, you know, you went to the Bowery to try to find drunks. By Friday and Saturday, you'd found some and you'd put them in the hospital. Now it's time. The weekend, it's time to start going in and bringing them the message. You know, you got them in the hospital bed, one right after another. Let's go tell them our story. Let's go tell them our story. And then by next Monday, you're meeting to discuss how it went that week and where you're going to go the next week. That's what AA looked like. It was a program of 12 steps with a support fellowship. What's happened with Alcoholics Anonymous today is it's become a fellowship with a sometimes support program. How many of us are out in hospitals and detoxes and mental hospitals looking for drugs today? Very few of us. I, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody. It's shifted to become a fellowship. And there's a number of reasons for that, I believe. But because of that, it's become a dangerous place for somebody who is really advanced with alcoholism. You can go into the wrong meetings with the wrong people and they are not going to offer you a solution sufficient to give you the power to stay separated from alcohol. Who in here has gone to meetings until the cows came home and still drank? This is a meeting where a lot of them show up. Alcoholism is in a scale. There's at least three places in the big book where it describes it. The chapter to wives is beautiful. It gives 1, 2, 3, and 4. A real nice example. There's another place in the doctor's opinion. But some of the verbiage is, no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you've all heard that because it's in How It Works. Another part of More About Alcoholism, it says, your ability to quit drinking on a non-spiritual basis, your ability to quit drinking if you don't do the steps, is going to be contingent on how much control you've lost in drink. So the scale of alcoholism isn't how many cars you've crashed or how much you drank or how long you drank. The scale, the barometer, is actually a barometer of power, choice, and control. Have you lost power, choice, and control over drink? And there are a lot of people that have. I had gotten to such a state where I really had. And it was only a matter of time, if I didn't discover those Joe and Charlie tapes, it was only a matter of time before North Jersey AA would have killed me. And I know there's got to be victims galore out there. What it is because it shifted from a program with a support fellowship to a fellowship with a sometimes support program, it opened the door so wide anybody could come in here. And in the 70s and the 80s, the people that survived in AA in North Jersey were basically the alcohol abusers. The alcohol-dependent people died. You know, that's really that's my impression on it. Now, there are areas of the country where there's been really, really strong recovery processes. Denver, Colorado, places in Texas, a lot of Southern California, a lot of places in Florida. There's some step working places. And then there's some fellowship places. Again, fellowship is a great place to be if you're an alcohol abuser. The recovery program is an absolute essential place to be if you're alcohol dependent. And you don't hear this enough at meetings because it's not politically correct. It certainly doesn't make me the most popular person in the room to share this over at the Tuesday night closed-minded discussion meeting. And I usually don't. But it's important for us to know. It's important for us to know. If you're a heavy drinker and a real alcoholic comes to you, don't try to sponsor them by bringing them over to your house and giving them tea. Okay? Pass them on to somebody with some experience with the steps. Again, the doors of AA are thrown wide open and for good reason. We want to be helpful to anybody who's having problems with alcohol. Alcoholics, heavy drinkers, we want to be helpful to anybody. I just am personally tired of seeing real alcoholics die in AA. AA was developed for the real alcoholic, and it got co-opted away somewhere. And today, I think there's a renaissance. This group is part of it. There's a lot of really strong home groups. There's a lot of really good big book groups that are popping up all over the country. The download sites are helping. You know, XA tapes and AA Primary Purpose, they're awesome because they don't put crap AA on the web. They put really good, valuable solution AA on. More and more, the download and the internet sites are really carrying a strong message of recovery. And I get emails from people all over the world who are starting big book groups in places that are dismal AA. I'm talking Australia and China and Scotland. I get emails all the time, and these people are starting hardcore big book groups and really starting to make a difference. So there's a renaissance going on worldwide that Joe and Charlie started in 1978. To get back to the basics, back to what actually worked for the alcoholic. Two things hurt us, and I'm going to finish with this. Two things hurt us. One of them was our fault, and one of them wasn't. The one that was our fault is toward the late 40s, Bill Wilson was putting the traditions together. Okay, he knew that we were so whacked that we needed something to keep us from blowing ourselves up. So what he did was he codified the 12 traditions that most of us are familiar with, if you're not, get familiar with them. he knew nobody would buy them. How many in here have the 12 concepts of world service on their bookshelves, honestly? All right, 4 out of 350, this is being recorded. I make my case, okay? He knew what was going to happen. So I have in the book, The Soulish Sponsorship, it's Bill Wilson's letters back and forth to Father Ed Dowling, one of his spiritual advisors. He tells Father Ed, we've put the 12 traditions together, and as bait, so that they will be bought, I have written 12 essays on the 12 steps. That's the step meetings that we've all gone to interminably. Those essays were written so that people would buy the traditions. Now, what happened when this book was published? We used to have big book meetings all the time. There used to be beginners meetings and big book meetings. That was the basic text. What happened when the 12 and 12 was published? All of a sudden, hey, there's a new book called The 12 and 12. And we've got time to read the whole step
in a meeting and there's 12 steps and every three months there's 12 weeks and we can get through the book four times in a year. It makes mathematical sense. Let's start a step meeting. And when I got sober, there was four step meetings in Basking Ridge alone, okay? Now here's what happens at step meetings. You read about the step, you share about the step, you philosophize about the step, you think about the step, you know, it's a cool, you hear about the step, but you don't do them! You ever been to a step meeting where people actually take the steps? I never have, you know? So what happened? The 12 and 12 hijacked the big book. Bill Wilson used to say, the good is sometimes the enemy of the best. Something may be really good. The step book is a good book. It's not even a good book. It's a great book. But it's the enemy of the big book. Because all of a sudden, when I got sober in 89, there was one big book meeting in Watchung where they read a paragraph and shared. And it took like 3 years to get through the book because they read the stories. You know, the interminable, boring, kill yourself, scratch your eyes out stories in the back of the book? You know, those are for identification purposes. We're not supposed to learn from those muttonheads. You know what I mean? They're not talking about the program in those stories. Anyway, again, I really try my best not to judge. So what we did is we watered down our own recovery process by publishing the 12 and 12, okay? Sorry, that's what happened. Another thing that happened was in 1956, the American Medical Society said that alcoholism is now a disease, okay? And drug addiction is now, they're diseases, followed very quickly by making it incumbent upon insurance companies to pay for this addictive illness. Anybody get sober in the 80s or early 90s? You couldn't shake a stick without hitting a rehab, right? There was four of them within walking distance of here. Everybody, let's start a rehab. I mean, the rehab I went to, they had counselors with like a year sobriety that they pulled out of AA. Can you imagine? I don't even want people with a year sober alone in my house. And there were our counselors. You know, so they were doing a really bad job. The insurance companies got pissed off. But what happened in the 70s and the 80s? What happened to AA? Where did people flood in from? They flooded in from the treatment centers. What did you do in treatment centers? Okay? Where do you think the discussion meetings came from? Where anybody who can raise their hand can share? Can you imagine? Just anybody. Where do you think that came from? So we watered ourselves down. You know, in the early days, they didn't even let anybody in the meetings. You had to be like working the steps to be allowed through the door. So what's happened? We've become a fellowship with a sometimes support recovery program. Why do I say all this stuff? Because this is Burnsville, the people that come to this group are enthusiastic about recovery. They understand the sense of urgency. They come from long distances sometimes to come to this meeting, to get a shot in the arm, you know, to get back out there in the trenches and really to make a difference and to try to help other alcoholics. And, I hope I've said maybe at least one thing tonight that'll encourage you to do that. That's all I got. Thanks.